In a moment, we're going to start around the August 25th reading. We're a little bit behind. We're going to cover a lot of ground today. But, you know, first off, I mean, this material to me has been very challenging. I'm so glad that we have this panel of experts that can weigh in and keep me on track. But let's lay a little groundwork first, because I think that's important, because this message today of the destruction of Jerusalem, Lamentation, that's some heavy stuff. Some very difficult to read stuff because of the judgment of the Lord. And it really brings me to a couple passages when I think about it. One is, you know, what Solomon said at the end of his book, you know, fear God, keep his commandments, is the whole duty of man. And two is, when you think about Hebrews, one of the passages that often comes up is in Hebrews 10, when it talks about, you know, we keep on sinning deliberately, we're going to be in the way of the judgment. And then in verse 31, it says, it is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. So those things really resonate with me when I think about the message. But there is a message of hope at the end of the, we'll get to that hopefully before the end of the class today. And I definitely encourage your feedback, your thoughts, and any questions will be sent over to the nearest Johnson, since Nathan's not here. Isaac will be answering your questions. You don't have to answer today. All right, so thanks a lot. So let's. I got a little bit of a PowerPoint to accompany this, so sorry for those on the tape, but let's go back and do a little background information. You know, we remember the children of Israel and what they went through, and many of you could explain that whole story and tell us better than I can. But in Deuteronomy, as we know, Moses went through a series of speeches. Before he would leave this earth, he would leave his people with a message to stay on track, a message to listen to God, or these things would happen. And so Deuteronomy 6, and this is skipping a couple of verses, but beginning in verse 10 in Deuteronomy 6, and when the Lord your God brings you into the land that he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give you with great and good cities that you did not build, and houses full of all good things that you did not fill, and cisterns that you did not dig, and vineyards and olive trees that you did not plant. And when you eat and are full, verse 12, then take care lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And skipping down to verse 14, it says, you shall not go after other gods, the gods of the peoples who are around you. For the Lord your God in your midst is a jealous God, lest the anger of the Lord your God be kindled against you, and he destroy you from off the face of the earth. So you know, that ties into today, of course. And skipping to Deuteronomy 28, we talk about this in a couple different places. I think Nathan's mentioned this several times. Deuteronomy 28, it talks about the blessings and the cursings. And it was God's people. It was their choice. And then essentially at the beginning of Deuteronomy 28, it said, and if you faithfully obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments that I command you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you, if you obey the voice of the Lord your God. Blessed you shall be. And it gives a series of blessed you shall be's over and over again. And so that's the one side, or the one choice. And that would be the choice of going the straight and narrow. I think in Deuteronomy many times it said, don't go to the right or to the left. And then at the end, a little bit further in the chapter, Deuteronomy 28, beginning in verse 13. And actually, let's jump to 28:15. But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord your God, or be careful to do all his commandments and all his statutes that I command you today, then all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. And really, it's prophetic in a way that God knew that they would do these things. And a lot of those curses were exactly what we're going to see at the end of Jeremiah. And Jeremiah talk back to it in Lamentations, in grieving and mourning about that. But there's a glimmer of hope. As with the blessings and the cursings, God has a plan of redemption. And it's a couple chapters later in Deuteronomy we see that. But so let's look at something else. So not only did God warn them way back when they entered the land of Canaan, he also spoke through his prophets. So here's a timeline of the prophets. So beginning, and you can see, on the, it's hard to read a little bit, but at the top it's the area active in Babylon, active in Judah, active in Israel. Of course, the Judah being the southern kingdom, Israel being the northern kingdom. We understand that Israel went into captivity with Assyria, and Judah was about to go, in our reading, into captivity with Babylon. So so we see several. We see Elisha and Elijah. You remember them in Israel. You remember Jonah, who preached to Assyria in particular. And then if we move on down the line, we have those that are preaching somewhat near this time, within 100 years or so. You've got Hosea says, "Because you have rejected knowledge, I reject you from being a priest to me." Hosea 4:6. And Amos says in Amos 2:4-5, "So I will send a fire upon Judah, and it shall devour the strongholds of Jerusalem." Micah 3:12, "Therefore, because of you, Zion shall be plowed as a field. Jerusalem shall become a heap of ruins." And all this time, the people could have repented. And then we have in Isaiah 39, and you may remember this, is really, it may have been the first time this got very specific. About 100 years before, I believe, before the actual Babylonians came to take the first captives, or around that, from what I remember. Isaiah 39, 5 and 6. Do we remember the backdrop of the story here? When Isaiah is talking to Hezekiah, what had just happened?
He shed all his treasures.
Right, so he, for some strange reason, decided to show the Babylonians all his treasures, kind of show off, give them a walkthrough. And Isaiah was like, "What have you done?" And in verse 5, he says, "Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days are coming when that all that is in your house, and which your fathers have stored up till this day, shall be carried off to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord." So, of course, this is sometime before, I think around 100 years before. And then we have several other prophets that come along. So one, Zephaniah 3:11 says, "On that day you shall not be put to shame because of the deeds by which you have rebelled against me. For then I will remove from your midst your proudly exultant ones." And really, you know, that may speak to the leaders of the time. Obviously not God-focused most of the time. Jeremiah 26:4-6. "Thus says the Lord, if you will not listen to me, to walk in my law that I have set before you, and to listen to my words and my servants the prophets, whom I send to you urgently, though you have not listened, then I will make this house like Shiloh, and I will make this city a curse for all the nations of the earth." So, anybody, what does that mean, to make this house like Shiloh? Anybody remember anything about Shiloh? I'll confess to you, I had to look it up. I forgot. So. Well, yeah, and the Lord had left there because there's a couple things. One is Shiloh is where the tabernacle was. From Joshua set the tabernacle up, and Shiloh remained there for a long, long time, even through the period of the judges. That's actually where Hannah prayed for a son. That's the time when Eli, you know, Hophni and Phinehas took the ark into battle, and the ark was lost. All that time, for the most part, the ark was in Shiloh. And when the temple, you know, we know the story about the Temple Mount, and I'm not going to go into it here, but eventually the ark was moved to Jerusalem, and the temple was built, you know, around where that ark landed at the end there. So God had left Shiloh, and just like God was left Shiloh, he was going to also leave Jerusalem. And so that's one prophecy from Jeremiah, as there are many. Ezekiel 22:3-4 says, "A city that sheds blood in her midst, so that her time may come, and that makes idols defile herself. You have become guilty by the blood that you have shed, and defiled by the idols that you have made, and you have brought your days near. The appointed time of your years has come." And of course, there's lots surrounding the idolatry. There's lots of evil, including sacrifice to these gods, the god of Molech, with people's own children. I think we read about Manasseh being involved in some of that. So that's a little bit of background. So as we come to this very difficult place, and I think if we didn't read it in context, it would be easy to say, why would God do such a thing? But you know, just as I think Nathan brought up a passage, see if I can find it. There's no way to, I don't know how he does what he does, but Hebrews 6, page 1646. It's talking in reference to Abraham, but the second paragraph under Christ's sacrifice, second sentence beginning, it says, because God wanted to make the unchangeable nature of his purpose very clear to the heirs of what was promised, he confirmed it with an oath. And I think this is the point that Nathan mentioned to me. God did this so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled to take hold of the hope offered to us may be greatly encouraged. So, you know, with God's promises for blessings, and it's unshakable, God's promises for judgment are the same. I mean, he promised these things. If you do this, this will happen. And that's what we see happen here. So any comments, any thoughts? All right. So I think I do have another. Well, I think that's maybe a duplicate. All right, so I'm going to switch over to PowerPoint so the screen gets bigger because my little iPad wouldn't handle the graphics on that one. So 1 second, please. So kind of in review of what the people actually did, we know this, but 2 Kings 17:11, about halfway through the verse, it talks about the children of Israel. And they did wicked things, provoking the Lord to anger. And they served idols, of which the Lord has said to them, you shall not do this. Verse 13, yet the Lord warned Israel and Judah by every prophet and every seer, saying, turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments and my statutes in accordance with all the law that I commanded your fathers and that I sent to you by my servants, the prophets. But they would not listen, but were stubborn, as their fathers had been, who did not believe in the Lord their God. They despised his statutes and gave his covenant that he made with their fathers and the warnings that he gave them. So we can see they made the choice to leave God. It even speaks to the gravity of they despised his statutes. So, you know, in some ways, they forced God's hand. So, all right. So as we move on in the reading, and I don't know that we covered much of this last time. Let's see, August 25th reading, beginning on page 1085, we start talking about the different nations. And just kind of goes from one nation to another. And on the screen you can see these nations surrounded the Israelites, the kingdom of Judah at the time. We have Ammon, Moab, Edom in the south, the Philistines on the west. And, you know, God's going to speak against all these nations. And why was this important in the prophecy? Or why would the Israelites care? It's a loaded question. There's about 15 answers. So why would this prophecy be important to the Israelites? And actually, if you read Lamentations even, Jeremiah brings one of these nations up. It's because they're bitter enemies, right? I mean, some of these folks they've been enemies with for really most of them centuries. When you have Ammon and Moab, the descendants of Lot, Edom, the descendants of Esau, the Philistines on the west. I mean, Ammon, you know, the first time I think that I remember reading of Ammon, and as I was looking through, was when Israel was coming into the land of Canaan to take it, they forbade them to come through their land. So even from the mild irritation of that, maybe Jephthah, the judge, fought against them. David fought against them. Saul fought against them. And then we get into Moab. We remember Moab at one point basically had Israel as their slaves because King Eglon was the king of Moab that Ehud killed in the judges. And then we have Edom. I don't know if I actually wrote the page number down for this, but if you turn to Psalms 137, turn there very quickly. Should give you kind of a little bit of a background on their thoughts of Edom. Someone want to read, I think it's only 9 verses, want to read Psalm 137?
Sorry, Dan, which one?
Psalm 137. Yes, really. This is really readable.
Dan, you just want me to read?
Sure, yeah.
All right. By the rivers of Babylon, we sat down, yet we wept. When we remembered Zion, we hung our hearts upon the lilies in the midst of it. For there are those who carried us away, captive asked for us a song, and those who plundered us requested mirth, saying, Sing us one of these songs, Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in the foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill. If I do not remember you, let my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy, remember, O Lord, against the sons of Edom, the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it, to the foundation. O daughter of Babylon, who are to be destroyed, happy the one who repays you as you have served us. Happy the one who takes the dashes, your little ones against the rock.
Thanks, Matt. All right, so we can see here, I mean, they were being ridiculed in all of this that was happening. I mean, I think the beginning is probably talking about the Babylonians saying, hey, sing us one of those songs. Obviously, a difficult thing to do. They'd been taken away from their homeland. They've seen their homeland. Many of them seen it burned to the ground. Difficult thing to do. But then we get to the Edomites in verse 7, and basically they were cheering on the destruction. They said, lay it bare down to its foundations, basically chanting to burn it to the ground. So we can see some of the animosity there, and God saying, hey, judgment against Israel, but here's all these other nations. Judgment against Egypt, 1087. We also go a couple more pages. We'll see judgment against Tyre, one of those coastal cities in the northwest part of the map. It's not on the screen anymore. But judgment against Tyre and what would happen to that. So it would be destroyed, never to be rebuilt in the exact same location. So kind of moving past that, let's go back to... Right. So kind of reviewing some of what we talked about last time, I believe. Does anyone... What do you guys think about Zedekiah? I mean, character-wise, what was he like?
Yeah.
I think Nathan, when we were talking Wednesday night right after church, he was just saying how much he waffled. You know, he's, but yeah, very indecisive. He really didn't have any backbone. Whoever was around, as we'll see in a moment, he just kind of would cater to whatever they asked for. But he becomes a puppet king back earlier in the reading, probably almost 3 or 4 weeks ago, and we're going to see him make multiple mistakes from the very beginning. You know, it said in 10:19, you don't have to turn there, but he said he did evil in the eyes of the Lord, just as Jehoiakim had done. Which Jehoiakim, I believe, his half-brother. Jehoiachin would have been his nephew. But it says he became stiff-necked and hardened his heart and would not turn to the Lord. And basically, a sentence later, people became more and more unfaithful. So terrible leadership on his part. And to Nikki's point, he was very indecisive. Occasionally, it would seem like he was going to do something good. I think Nathan brought this up before. 1037, King Zedekiah decides to release the slaves. Everyone was free to, and on page 1037, everyone was free to, free his Hebrew slaves, both male and female. No one was to hold a fellow Jew in bondage. Of course, we know that's prescribed by the law in many ways. At a certain time, they were to let their own people go in the year of Jubilee. But afterward, they changed their minds and took back the slaves they had freed and enslaved them again. So instead of Zedekiah standing up, he just allowed that to happen. And of course, that was God was very unpleased with that and said some things about that. And then if we turn on to 1070, and I'm just trying to get through Zedekiah real quick so we get a better picture of who he is, or reminded who he is. 1070, it said, for some reason at some point in time, of course he's a puppet king, Babylon's ultimately in control, but he decides it's a good idea to rebel against King Nebuchadnezzar. So we read about that in 1070, and really that's where the whole siege started, because he decided to rebel against, really ultimately, he reports to, and now we're going to see the walls close in on the people. So for a period of 1.5 to 2 years, probably, the people, you know, may be protecting from the outside with the walls, but now they can't get to food. And we're going to see starvation, famine, all those terrible things would come with being trapped in inside the walls. All right, so, you know, we talked about a little bit, God promises to raise up a righteous branch of David. And on 1083, Jeremiah 23:5, we talked about that a little bit already. Nathan explained it way much better than I can. But essentially, instead of it coming from the line of Jeconiah, or Jehoiachin is his other name, we will see the righteous branch of David coming from Jesus in a more spiritual kingdom sense. We have a promise of a new covenant on 1084, a very familiar passage in Jeremiah 31, where God says, I will put my law on their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. No longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother, saying, know the Lord, because they will all know me. And certainly a reference to spiritual Israel. Any comments? So we'll pick up today on 1097. And so back to a little bit about Zedekiah. Coincidentally, he asked, and again, we're under siege. The walls are closed in, as I understand it. Jeremiah is there to watch everything. Zedekiah asked for Jeremiah to come and to pray for him. Let's see, the beginning of 1097. King Zedekiah, however, sent Jehukal, son of Shelemiah, with the priest Zephaniah, son of Messiah, to Jeremiah the prophet with this message, please pray to the Lord our God for us. And at this time, it says, Jeremiah was free to come and go among the people, for he had not yet been put in prison. So Jeremiah brings a message, and basically he says, tell the king of Judah in the next paragraph, who sent you to inquire of me, Pharaoh's army, which has marched out to support you, will go back to his own land, to Egypt. Then the Babylonians will return to and attack the city. They will capture it and burn it down. So all this time, Zedekiah, although he's technically reporting to Nebuchadnezzar, he's tried to create an alliance with Egypt. Because in his mind, you know, maybe the Egyptians will help him get out of this mess. And Egypt, in some ways, as we learned earlier, enjoyed having Israel as a buffer between Babylon and themselves. So there was some, you know, some logical reason for that. But, you know, Jeremiah is basically saying, you know, the next paragraph he says on page 1097, this is what the Lord says. Do not deceive yourselves thinking the Babylonians will surely leave us. They will not. Even if you were to defeat the entire Babylonian army that is attacking you, and only wounded men were left in their tents, they would come out and burn the city down. Again, Jeremiah brings this very difficult message, and he's, you know, you kind of feel sorry for Jeremiah as you read about this and you read through the book, because Jeremiah, you know, we all remember what he started as. He started as a priest. His job was to go to God on behalf of the people. And God, when he chose Jeremiah, he said, I'm changing that, turning it the other way around. You're going to go to the people on behalf of me. So that's a tough message now, because originally it was, you know, he would go to God on behalf of the people. So now we see a message, and over again, Jeremiah is very reluctant, but he follows God's will, and he delivers this very difficult message, and that's probably the reason the next paragraph actually happens. So we remember from last class, Jeremiah had redeemed a piece of land, and I think it's Anathoth, and he's going to go back there. He said, Jeremiah started to leave in the next paragraph, to go to the territory of Benjamin to get his share of the property among the people there. But when he reached the Benjamin gate, the captain of the guard, whose name was Arijah, son of Shelemiah, the son of Hananiah, arrested him and said, you are deserting to the Babylonians. And of course, Jeremiah denies that. He's not. He's going to his piece of land. And they still arrested Jeremiah, brought him to the officials, and you know, he's beaten, he's thrown into Jonathan the secretary's own prison, which is essentially a vaulted cell in a dungeon, as how it describes it on 1098. You know, he stays there a long time. So I don't know how long time is, but it was not pleasant. And Zedekiah, you know, being the good guy that he is, asked Jeremiah to come to him again. He wanted to talk to him. But this time he asked him privately, very interestingly enough, in Jeremiah 37:17. Again, he's very weak. So he doesn't want to do this in front of other people. He says, "Is there any word from the Lord?" And Jeremiah replied, "You will be handed over to the king of Babylon." And the next paragraph, then Jeremiah said to King Zedekiah, "What crime have I committed against you or your officials or this people that you have put me in prison?" And he says a few sentences later at the end of the paragraph, "Do not send me back to the house of Jonathan the secretary, or I will die there." So, you know, Zedekiah heard Jeremiah there. He placed him in the courtyard instead of the dungeon and basically was told people to give him food as long as there was food to eat. And, of course, they would run out of food. But as long as he was in the courtyard and there was bread, he would get bread from the bakers every day. And so then we get to the next section. Jeremiah says, and it says a few others heard him say this. He was telling the people, "This is what the Lord says. Whoever stays in this city will die by the sword, famine, or plague, but whoever goes over to the Babylonians will live. He will escape with his life. He will live." So basically telling them to bow down to the Babylonians, not bow down literally, but you know what I mean, give in to their authority, and basically been, you know, if you're willing to do that, you know, they would be allowed to live. Embrace the punishment that God had had planned for them, essentially. So then what happens is Jeremiah is thrown into a cistern. And a cistern, as I understand it, is a way to store water. You know, normally it would be covered up with something. Apparently it was pretty dry because this cistern didn't have much in it. So there was just mud in the bottom. And Jeremiah was thrown into that. And here's a, let's see, if a picture of, I had a picture, I believe, of kind of a layout of, you know, you had a rock over it potentially, then you had this pear-shaped place in the ground, and Jeremiah was thrown down in there. We can't imagine what that would have been like, that he was just thrown in this pit to stay. And who remembers who actually petitioned Zedekiah to get him out of there? So is it one of his brothers, one of his fellow Israelites? That was, yeah, Cushite. So Ebed Melech, the Cushite. And he took 30 men and lifted Jeremiah out of it after he asked Zedekiah. Zedekiah's like, sure, why not? Very very helpful. So he saved him. We'll read about, and you may have noticed, Ebed Melech again mentioned. Because the Lord obviously had compassion on him, because maybe because of the mercy he had, and I guess he feared the Lord. Then we get to, I guess probably to talk about some of Zedekiah's options. The next page, 1099, Jeremiah is still in the courtyard, and Zedekiah sent for him again. And so he's been in a dungeon, in the courtyard, in a cistern, back to the courtyard, and Zedekiah is saying, "Hey, bring him over here, I need to ask him a question." He said, "I am going," and he brought him to the third entrance to the temple of the Lord on in Jeremiah 38:14. So I'm kind of wondering again, is it more of the secret thing? Hey, meet him over the back entrance. I'm going to talk to him for a minute. And he said, "Don't hide anything from me. I'm going to ask you something." But King Zedekiah swore this oath secretly to Jeremiah, "Surely as the Lord lives, who has given us breath, I will neither kill you nor hand you over to those who are seeking your life." I'm not sure that I would believe him if I was Jeremiah. But and then Jeremiah 38, beginning in verse 17, he said, "This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. If you surrender the officers of the king of Babylon, your life will be spared, and this city will not be burned down. You and your family will live. But if you will not surrender to the officers of the king of Babylon, this city will be handed over to the Babylonians, and they will burn it down. You yourself will not escape from their hands." And of course, he fears surrender. Jeremiah ensures him to, "Hey, obey the Lord. Do what I tell you." And what did Zedekiah do? So, yeah, the next page, essentially, page 1100, and it said, "By the ninth day of the fourth month, the famine in the city had become so severe there was no food for the people to eat." And on the ninth day of the fourth month of Zedekiah's 11th year, the city wall was broken through. And so we're going to see all these things that have been promised to happen because of the people and their decisions. It says, when Zedekiah, king of Judah, and all the soldiers saw them, they fled. And we know that Zedekiah is going to be captured. Zedekiah is going to have to watch his own sons killed before his eyes, and then his eyes are... they take out his eyes. So, and then the destruction of the city happens. Basically, many people are killed. There's no discretion for who's killed and not killed. I think they just go around killing the people in the city. Says he set fire to the temple of the Lord at the bottom of page 1100. The royal palace and all the houses of Jerusalem. Every important building he burned down. And in the next page, whatever treasures were not already taken, it says underneath, around Jeremiah 52:17, the commander of the imperial guard took away the basins, censers, sprinkling bowls, pots, lampstands, dishes, and bowls used for drink offerings, all that were made of pure gold or silver. And then we have more deportations that take place. So what we see is now we have basically four deportations. The nobles and Daniel are taken in the first instance of this in the first year 1605. The second instance in 597, that's when the Jehoiakim, really the last true king of Israel, was taken along with Ezekiel. And then, of course, these last few years, Zedekiah has been in charge really under the authority of Nebuchadnezzar himself. But then we have third Jerusalem, and there's a small group of 745 Jews taken in 582, and all that can be found in Jeremiah 52, or most of that can be found there. So who said this? This is an interesting quote. It may already say it already says it. Well, never mind that. So Jeremiah 40, it's interesting that this comes from the opposition, from the enemy, from Nebuzaradan, the commander of the Babylonian guard. But he took Jeremiah aside. This is after or during all the destruction. And he says, the Lord your God pronounced this disaster against this place. The Lord has brought it about and has done as he said. Because you sinned against the Lord and did not obey his voice, this thing has come to you. I just find it interesting that we have a message from the enemy, from the Babylonians, and I'm not sure how he got this message, if it came directly from God, if it came from Israelites that were already in Babylon. But God spread, you know, and some things God has always glorified, right? This is terrible judgment on those that had sinned. But still, there are people that are learning about how powerful and how awestruck we should be of God.
Dan, one thing I was thinking about, I mean, is that where, you know, he probably got that information from Nebuchadnezzar himself and all that? And you think about what, you know, God revealed to Pharaoh at the time about his role in these things, you know.
Yeah, and that was what Josiah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just, I think the lesson is that God is. Cyrus, you know, what he'll reveal to him. You know, just these things are, I mean, God is doing, I mean, he's doing his will.
Right. And really, God and some of what God was all about was coming to the Babylonians, you know, in more ways than ever before because of these Israelites. And obviously, we see in this story that Nebuzaradan has mercy on Jeremiah, basically lets him choose where he wants to go, and that may have been Gedaliah, who in page 1102, essentially Jeremiah 39, Gedaliah, and actually 2 Kings 25:22, Gedaliah is made governor. Nebuchadnezzar puts Gedaliah in charge. He's going to lead the people for a short time. And so one of the names we just mentioned about 5 minutes ago, Ebed-Melech, that Cushite, that said, hey, you got to get Jeremiah out of that pit. He's warned by God, and basically it says God basically tells Jeremiah to tell Ebed-Melech. He says, I'm about to fulfill my words against the city through disaster, but I will rescue you on that day, declares the Lord. You will not be handed over to those you fear. I will save you. You will not fall by the sword, but will escape with your life because you trust in me, declares the Lord. And chronologically, I'm not exactly sure why this is not back a little bit further. There may be a good reason, but essentially Ebed-Melech is ensured that, that he's going to be okay and for trusting in God. So even through all that difficulty, he was protected. Jeremiah is saved. Gedaliah gives him an option whether or not, hey, you can go back to Babylon, I'll treat you well, or you can stay in your homeland. And Jeremiah.
Do you think he chose to stay? And when I read that, I kept wondering, was that, I wonder if that would have been okay with God for him to have left. And I mean, I don't know. And it doesn't really tell us because it's offered not by God. I mean, obviously he had God's words in him because he knew the prophecy. He knew that, you know, the whole reason this was happening is because the people had not done what they were supposed to do. But it made me wonder, you know, did he stay for the love of his people and the fact that God, that's what God had asked him to do, was talk to the people? Or would it have been okay if he had decided to go on to Babylonia with, you know, the people who had already been taken captive?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't really thought much about that, but that's a great point. And we see a couple days later in our reading how bad it gets for Jeremiah because he stayed.
Yes.
So maybe he should have left, but I mean, I guess there's no way to know. Any thoughts on that?
So, I can't remember where, but I'm thinking I remember God told Jeremiah to stay in this land. If you go to Egypt, you'll die there. I think he even told him if he goes to Babylon, he'll die there.
I remember that Egypt. Whether he told him, that's why I kind of was asking that question.
Now, Jeremiah winds up being kidnapped and taken there, basically kidnapped, taken to Egypt. Mm-hmm. We don't really know what happened to Jeremiah, do we? I think Jewish tradition says he eventually got to come back, but I think we know that.
Right. Yeah, it was definitely difficult for him in Egypt, and I'm not sure on that. That's an interesting thought. So there's, I guess, a couple different directions we can go here, but let's just jump over to 11:03. Yeah, I think we only have a few minutes left, really. So as we get into Lamentations, and I believe this is essentially five funeral poems, essentially. A lament, or so we start out, and he's, you know, just try to imagine Jeremiah's situation. He's been through Israel his whole life. He's seen it in somewhat in prosperity, and now he's walking through the city in its current situation. You know, he says how desolate lies the city, once so full of people, once great among the nations. Bitterly she weeps at night, tears upon her or upon her cheeks. Among all her lovers, there is none to comfort her. All her friends have betrayed her. They have become her enemies. And maybe that's because they trusted in the wrong places. The next page, 11:04, the roads to Zion mourn. For no one comes to her appointed feast. Her foes have become her masters. Her enemies are at ease, later on down in the verses. And we read earlier in our reading that the glory left the temple. And, you know, Lamentations 1:7-11, in the days of reflection and wondering, Jerusalem remembers all the treasures that were hers of days of old. When her people fell into enemy hands, there was no one to help her. Her enemies looked at her and laughed at her destruction. And then it says, Jerusalem has sinned greatly and so has become unclean. And later it says her fall was astounding. And that kind of goes back to Habakkuk. We remember reading about God telling Habakkuk that there would be a great wonder and astoundment, and you wouldn't even believe it if I told you all the destruction that was going to come to Jerusalem. And so, jumping on over a couple of pages, because I think in the essence of time, there's more and more of this, essentially almost walking through Jerusalem and seeing the destruction and all that had gone terribly wrong because of the judgment of God for the sinful people. But halfway down through page 1110, and at Lamentations 3, I think it's about verse 21, he says this. He says, yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Verse 22, because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. For his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. And if you recall that from a song we sing occasionally, great is thy faithfulness. This is most likely the verse that that song came from. In times of great difficulty, God is still there. His love is essentially unextinguishable. I mean, it may seem bleak, but God's love is still there, and His love is new every morning. And what Jeremiah says in Lamentations here is, he says, "I will wait for Him. The Lord is good to those who hope in Him, to the one who seeks Him. It is good to wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord." And then if you skip down a couple of paragraphs, it has this message, which I think is encouraging to each one of us. No matter how bad it gets, no how bad our mistakes are, it's not too late. And it basically says, "For men are not cast off by the Lord forever. Though He brings grief, He will show compassion. So great is His unfailing love, for He does not willingly bring affliction or grief to the children of men." He doesn't delight in affliction. This was something that people brought on themselves. So that's something, you know, to think about there. But there were consequences to the sin. And the next page, 1111, you know, it said, which is a very human thing to do, is to say, "Why did God do this to me?" And I think that's, you know, some of what the people might have done that were still left. Even Jeremiah struggled with this and seeing all the death and destruction, terrible things that had happened. But it says, "Why should any living man complain when punished with his sins?" On that page, sin bring consequences. And what Jeremiah says is, "Let us examine our ways and test them. And let us return to the Lord. Let us lift up our hearts and our hands to God in heaven and say, we have sinned and rebelled, and you have not forgiven." And that's what their thought might have been at that point. But God would forgive. And down on the page, Jeremiah says, "My eyes will flow unceasingly without relief until the Lord looks down from heaven and sees. What I see brings grief to my soul because of all the women of my city. Those who were my enemies without cause hunted me like a bird. They tried to end my life in a pit and threw stones at me. The waters closed over my head and I thought I was about to be cut off." And then it says, "I called on your name, O Lord, from the depths of the pit. You heard my plea. Do not close your ears to my cry for relief." And it says, "You came near when I called you, and you said, do not fear. O Lord, you took up my case. You redeemed my life." And, you know, in the end result of this, when the people came back 7 years later, we don't see the idolatry problem anymore. You know, the idolatry problem in the New Testament, when we get there, for the Israelites themselves, was gone. I mean, God had accomplished that remnant. When they came back, they remembered these things, and they wrote them down, and it was on their heart. I mean, they had a lot of other problems, but the idolatry problem was not one of them. You know, I think some of what we see in the remnant that flees to Egypt on 1115 is how bad things have become. You see those people, the massacres, the assassination of Gedaliah. Even though God really put him in place through Nebuchadnezzar, they assassinated him, they rebelled, they asked for Jeremiah's advice, they did whatever they wanted. They even mentioned the idolatry in Egypt as being something that they needed to do. So we see how bad things have become for those people, and we really see why God's judgment was needed to begin with. All right, thanks, guys.